Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he...
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Cahoga Falls.
All right, time for another installment of It's My House. And this is December the 1st, 2022. Okay, let's go to the phone lines here. 30, area code 309. Good morning, Chris. And what's the latest updates?
Good morning, good morning. They are having a wonderful show down there in Miami. I think he's going to be calling in this morning. So we will have Carlos on for a little bit. I'm actually heading over to my property that I have in Bloomington, Illinois, where I had the tent city set up, helping out some veterans, some elderly, and some women. So I'm going over here to pick up the remnants of everything and take it to the dump. So that's one of the missions I'm on.
Okay. I understand they had several storms, tornadoes, have passed through quite a few states. I don't know if it was yesterday or 2 days ago. I just found out about it about a couple of hours ago, but probably knocked out some towers or what have you.
Oh yeah, and you know, even the volcano happening in Hawaii.
I didn't hear about that either.
Yeah, they've got lava flowing, you know.
Okay.
So
yeah, I know they had some.
Things are happening all over.
right. Well, they are. Now the Miami event. What's today? Thursday. So was today the first day or yesterday the first day?
What was that question?
The event, the Miami event, did it start today did it start yesterday? Because today's Thursday. It goes to the Sunday, I know.
It actually started on the 29th, but Art Basel goes from the 1st, 2nd, and the 3rd. But it's all of the other, attractions that are going on, all the other art shows. And that's one's the Frigid Art Fair, and that one goes on from the 29th to the 3rd. So they actually started the art show we're doing yesterday for sure. Yeah, they were definitely in it and going hard at it.
Okay. And it goes all the way to the 3rd, which is Thursday. Sunday. Well, today's the 1st. So what, Friday's the 2nd? All the way till Saturday.
Yeah, Saturday at 6 p.m. I think it's over.
Right, okay. All right. Did they have any forecasts on the amount of people that they think that will be coming through?
No, I haven't heard a forecast on that.
Okay.
Maybe Carlos will be able to, when he comes on, he might be able to give us some updates to that.
All right. Let's see. Well, let's get back to what we were talking about yesterday. I went for a 2-mile walk, which I normally do, but I guess I hadn't been drinking enough water, so I didn't call you back yesterday. But anyway, so let's start off from there. So let's go with, like he was sharing with us a few times, these teenagers that hadn't built anything before. They were able to, I guess, assemble a building within, what time period was it?
They built a frame in the factory, wanting to say it was all in a week that they had worked on it. And at the end of the week, the frame went out to the site, and they actually stood it up. And it took them 2 days to stand it up because we didn't push them to the trusses on the first day. But they put all the walls up in one day, and they came back the next day, and they put the trusses on. Now, as far as the tiny house situation that we had two kids do, I was a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old. They actually built that in 2.5 hours, the frame of it.
That's the frame. So now before we can even get to the frame, the parts of the frame had to be made first, which would be the walls, floors, roof, that type of stuff. So now let's start there. Average time with let's go with the tiny house, those figures of square feet, to make the walls, and let's keep it simple. Let's say you've got maybe just two sides have windows. Oh, no, I'll make it three. Two on the side and one on the back. You know what? This is make it four. A window for each side. So you would need a skilled person to, I guess, do the cuts. And so how many people do you anticipate, just to keep it simple, let's eliminate that. No, you need a window on the front. Four sides, four windows, and a door frame to enter. How long to make those cuts? Just the prefab part of it for the frame.
Well, if I'm making the framework, I'll already have everything pre-cut for you. So all you got to do is assemble it.
Okay. All right.
Because all of our material comes out to length. So whatever you need, we're going to just give you that.
All right. So, all right, well, assembly. So I guess what we were talking about one day, you had about four or five people?
Yeah.
To assemble it.
You know, if you had three people and one experienced person, you can build, because the one person, you know, if you got to cut plywood or whatever, put it on the outside of it, you know, they can do it and not hold anything back, and people trying to learn and do things. Anytime you're working with power tools, you know, you need somebody that has some kind of experience and common sense, you know. So that's one reason
right.
I wanted to do this without the kids having to touch a saw. And that's the beautiful part about this. They don't have to put the frames together. All they got to do is hold a screw gun in their hand, put some screws to it. So it's more just
okay.
You know,
then that's the only power tool they would be using.
Yeah, it's a screw gun.
Okay, all right. Well, that's simple. I know this. This guy Tom Saray, who owns the company Tough Shit. I think last July, now he doesn't, he started off by making one shed for himself, then he expanded from there. But last July, his company, Tough Shed, I think they did 10,000 sheds in a month. last July. Now, yeah. With that said, I'm sure all those jobs were subcontracted out because I think that was within, I think he did that within about 15 to 20 states. But I think he works with a lot of independent contractors.
Right.
Not employees. So that's how he was able to...
For an example, you know, we do have the 70 people working in Tennessee. They're building 8-foot by 20-foot tiny houses.
Right.
Ready, complete, kitchen, bathroom, the whole deal. They've built 310 of them since April. Every day, 5 more comes off the line.
All right, now that's so, the guy, I think Randy Jones. Yeah, they do. They have a crew of about 7 per house per day.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it might be more. They're doing 5 houses right now per day.
All right. And that's a 35-man crew, 7 people per house. I'm impressed by that number. And that's amazing. He started just by himself.
Yep.
Yeah, he just built one house just for himself, and then, I mean, the way I heard the story, and then after that, somebody asked, well, can you build me one? And he did it with, I think he said with, there's no institutional funding at all with his operation. That's how it was at one time. I don't know how it is now, but yeah, very interesting story. Very interesting story. So, all right, now back to the challenge, which we brought about. Refresh our memories on that, and particularly for new people that are just tuning in. The challenge for December is, because today's December 1st.
Yes.
Can you hear me? What's the challenge for December?
Well, to bring a frame anywhere in the country. Now, how long does it take you to put people together? How long does it take you to, you know, it don't take a whole lot of money if you get a group that's willing to do it to change someone's life. There is grants out there. They take time. I know that I've got a team of people that I just shared the number with to come on the call. So if your phone line starts coming up, let me know that there's some on there, and I'll tell you what their area codes are. These are
okay.
Search and rescue teams. These are all the people that are out here across the country trying to do some things. We're working on some things down in Fort Myers, Florida right now. Because there was, you know, I want to tell you, you know, a homeless man came up during the hurricane and started helping the search and rescue team and never asked for nothing. But they found out how skilled he was, you know, how amazing he is, because there's all of you are amazing. If you don't give someone a chance, you'll never know. But, you know, they helped him. There was somebody that wound up, you know, letting him stay at their house temporarily after the team had left. But we want to figure him out something. So we've got a bunch of people that are, you know, a whole lot of collaborators down there in Fort Myers right now. And we're trying to see about doing 100 acres. They're talking about giving us 5 acres of it, donating 5 acres of it to start, and that'll be amazing for that to happen. Because, you know, we could call it the 100-acre woods, but it's time to get the people, you know, anywhere and everywhere, every city you are, I'm putting a challenge out. You get a hold of us and tell us that you want to do something, and we're going to show up. But when we do it, we're going to stay there. It's not, I don't have to stay, but the program will. You can always have more.
Right.
You can continue to have more. So it's planting that seed. You know, let people see what they can do, what other people can do.
just by sharing a message is powerful. You know, social currency. We talk about it on here all the time. You know, if that's going to do is share a message, well, how many people can you reach by sharing a message? You know, what is your reason for being here? What is your why in life? People need to know that. So, and the people that are lost, they don't know why, because they're lost. They need to be found. They need to understand that they are important. They all matter. Everyone matters. And, you know, be the change you want to see. So this challenge is, I'm challenging the country, every person, any person that can hear me. Let's claim your problems. I need to know what they are. If you don't ever tell me what they are, I'll never know. So right. You have to claim the problem yourself by telling us what the problem is so that we can make a difference what we're doing. You know, I can send material. We got machines that make 2 feet of material per second. There's 3 factories that will produce material, go anywhere. And if you're on Section 8 anywhere in the country, I want you to hear this. You do not have to be paying a landlord. You can become a homeowner. We got that legislation passed. But it takes you to step up and want to do it. So the people that think that they're stuck where they're at, you're not stuck anywhere. There's no limit to how far you can go and what can happen. So this challenge is get a hold. Let's do something. I'm calling you out. Let's get together. Let's make a difference. We can change people's lives in an hour or two, and it'll change yours because it'll clean your city streets up. People won't be suffering. People won't be trying. You know, it's cold here in Illinois. It's cold. And I've got 3 homeless people right now that I work with and help out as much as I can. And they're over here cleaning up everything that 7 people had lived here for a little over 2 months. And they're cleaning it up. They do care. You just have to give them a chance. I just asked them, will you guys go help me clean this up? And they said yes. They didn't ask me how much are you giving me, because they know that if they need something, I'm there for them if I can be. And that's what I need. You know, people need to ask the question, you know, who are you when no one's around? That question's for yourself, you know, when you get to create and make a sound. So I'm going to keep, you know,
The first step with this challenge is for people to organize a community, and that can be a small number. I mean, community can be 2 or 3 people. So I guess that would be the first step. To do that, and well, everything starts with one. So that's an individual solo, but like I say, if you get 2 or 3 people, let's say at least three on board, and there are plenty of ways you can come up with that 3 through just off the top of my head, advertising, using social media, Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace. They have forums on Facebook. And I'm sure different various podcasts and all that. So 3 people that they need a place to stay. And there are plenty of those people around. Matter of fact, I know of one that which I'm thinking if I can track him down and get him to call in. Let's see. I have to get some interlude going first. So, while you guys hear the interlude stuff, oh, you know what? Wait a minute. I know her past one. Yeah, I'm going to see if I can get this homeless guy. And possibly two. Let me see. All right, what we're going to do, I'm going to play two or three interludes, and I'm going to see what kind of community we can get up to get this challenge going. So we'll be back in a matter of minutes, hopefully to start a community right here. All right, we're back with It's My House, and I had a couple, well, I contacted a couple people, so let's see, one in New York State and one in North Carolina, so they see, let's see if they'll call in. All right, and these are two people that need some permanent housing. All right, Chris, we got, what area code do you want me to look out for?
Actually, I've been waiting for them. I tell people to text me their area codes if they called in, so just pick one.
All right, I got one person at 810. 810. You know what is 810? Is that Michigan? Well, I'm open up their mic. Area code 810, your mic is open.
Hey, Chris, it's Rob. How you doing?
Hey, Rob. Nice. I thought that might be you.
Yes, sir. It's me. Just sitting here listening to the program.
Brother.
Yeah, listening to the program and hearing what you all got to say. Just tuned in, so I wasn't really sure what the topic was today or not. But I wanted to talk to you about this housing project in Fort Myers that we've been talking about for needy people, veterans, and people with mental, emotional disabilities, or what I call challenged people, that are falling through the cracks. We noticed when we was down there for Hurricane Ian, as we discussed, as a storm, and our organization was down there for Hurricane Ian doing disaster relief, that a lot of these people are being left out in the open and with no help. The programs that they have available at this point in time for these people are being overrun and overwhelmed by an influx of immigrations and people moving to the area. So there's the programs that are designed to help these people are not really available. And then most of the trailer parks that got nailed by the hurricane have been condemned. And many of these trailer parks had veterans and underprivileged people with, you know, that were challenged living. And now they have no place to live now. Either they'd be forced to find any place to live or they're homeless. So we were hoping that Hope for Housing and Storm Search and Rescue Disaster Relief and IDRT and a couple other organizations that are getting together will be able to form an organization or a collective organization to address these needs for these people. The problem is we just started discussing it. So we don't really have all the details that we need collectively to go forward. But we have already started applying for grants as an organization. Storm has. We're applying for these grants, these cyber grants, to try and get some of the initial funding we need to get this off the ground. Now, my question today is this. For Hope for Housing, if there is a place, like a trailer park, for instance, all right, that's condemning everybody on the park, and nobody can go back. Can you use that material? Is it helpful to you to even use that material?
The framework would be everything else. You know, there might be a little bit of aluminum sheeting on the side of it. It might be metal. Really, there's not much to a trailer. Most of it is
a wood frame.
And it goes up very fast, and it burns even the floorboards are made of sawdust. So the thing is, though, is we can take that frame off of that, or take the entire house frame off of the frame. We can make sure the frame is straight, and we can build it right there in the trailer park. So we could go in and clean all that off. If the frame is still good, we can use it. If it's not good, then we can get rid of it altogether and build something brand new right there. If it needs to be on a frame, it can be. And most of trailer parks, you know, they've got a slab already there for you to park it on. So if you have a slab, we should be able to go right to the slab and put a building on top of it.
My concern is this, is that most of the trailer parks don't want to rebuild. They want to rebuild high rent travel and tourism housing. They don't want to rebuild trailers. So they're basically telling these guys that they're basically SOL and you can't live here anymore. And by the way, we're not going to bring trailers back for you. We're going to build other housing that they can't afford. So the problem is, you know, we could probably get the material because, hey, they want the material out of there, you know. Otherwise, they're going to send it to a scrapyard. And, you know, if you're able, your organization is able to use that material and it could be useful, I'd rather find a way to get that material for you rather than send it to a scrapyard or a junkyard or wherever else it is that they're taking it down there. I was told when I was down there that the salvage yards they have, disposal sites they have, are overwhelmed with all the debris and that they're actually building new disposal sites to get rid of most of this stuff. So it's true or not, but they did that in a couple other states for other hurricanes, so I'm not surprised if that's what they're having to do. I mean, this was a huge storm, and it caused a lot of damage and debris, so they have no place to really put that stuff. So anyways, they want to put trailers back there. So my concern was just to get the debris out of there, but you know, and then you know, finding another place to build something for these guys.
See, that's the thing. You know, it'd be better if we could just buy the property, that you know, the trailer park, and not let them develop it, and that way we can keep it affordable housing. You know, that's key, you know, finding them properties that are already destroyed, that are already kind of laid out. Yes, we could use the washers, dryers, refrigerators, stoves that are in those trailers. But, you know, all that material can be recycled and be made into the material we build the frame out of. And that's working with the recycling centers that are right there. And if they, you know, if they have to build new recycling centers, that's not something that happens overnight.
But you can bring in
crushers and things like that. I know when Houston happened, you know, they had different spots where the white goods would go for, you know, anything that would have Freon in it. So that way they could have somebody there doing nothing but taking the Freon out, because we don't want this stuff just to go out in the atmosphere. We want it done correctly.
No.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I know that they are doing in the disasters as of 2010. Before that, they were not doing that. They had no clue what to do. And that's just hard to believe that we went through, you know, this long. But, you know, showing the people in Nashville, they were able to ignite all of the organizations that clean up and all the different things and change the way we recover these disasters. Now, the difference is we do need to use that material to build affordable housing for the people that have lost their housing, the people that never had any housing, and, you know, create a purpose. So could the material be used? Yes. Will all of it be used? No, because they built it out of wood.
Sure.
But, you know, even that, it can be recycled as long as it hasn't gotten the mold and all that to it. That stuff can be recycled and made into the particle board, you know, the OSB, the oriented strand board that we need. That's made by chipboard. You know, it's just pieces of wood. So, you know, yes, there's ways of creating it, you know, making it happen. The one thing I would think, though, is utilizing what's already laid out. If it's laid out for a trailer park, you know, we can build something beautiful. It don't have to necessarily be a bunch of trailers go back in there that you know, turns into something that's low income. Because people can have a purpose afterwards and a good job if they need one.
You're right. I when I was in the Keys for Hurricane Irma, they didn't condemn every trailer park. There was a trailer park, I remember, in Grassy Key, that they just took all the old decrepit trailer parks that were from the 60s, 70s, and 80s or whatever and pulled them out. Most of them got ruined anyways, and they brought in these newer ones that were like two stories with a loft bedroom on top, and, you know, they looked more like, you know, seaside homes than they did trailers, but they're still trailers. And, you know, they're a little more costly, but they look better, you know. So, I mean, that might be – you know, if they look that nice, and I have seen the layouts and they're pretty nice, that would be an incentive for them, I'm sure. The thing is to get there and talk to these people. My concern is this, is that up here in Michigan, when you scrap something out, it goes right to a steel mill, and it gets melted down into you know, plate steel or rolled steel, and then that goes to a steel mill somewhere, or where they a fabricating place somewhere where they fabricate it and turn it into beams or whatever else. How does the process work for you guys? If you're working with scrap yards, I'm not sure what Florida has for steel mills or anything, but I would assume that they have to send that somewhere to get melted down and processed.
There's actually steel mills in every state. There's recycling centers in every state. We don't have to build any of them. There's like, I'm wanting to say there was 5,600 recycling centers that the National Steel Institute in Washington, D.C. got a hold of and sent a blog out about us, asking every one of them to handle the material that we would bring into their place. We would pay them for handling it. But that material just gets logged for weight. And then they transfer that amount of weight to the steel mill, and the steel mill gives us that amount of weight of material they've already made that makes the material we make by putting it on the machine. We have those fabricating factories.
Sure.
So working through all that, that would be how that would come together. It would be the community realizing that they're going to be making a difference right here by utilizing this material and creating a sustainable job. You know, not everybody's going to be a steel framer, but it's going to be impacting 1,000 different careers. So as we do this, you know, everybody has to be dealt with individually. And that's the part I like about what you said about the veterans and, you know, mental issues and stuff, because we can't just give somebody a home and think they're going to be fine.
No.
This is not how you fix the problem. That is putting a Band-Aid on it.
Right.
So, you know, giving people the services and communication, you know, we're key to having meeting communication. We are social. And without it, we start feeling in a negative way if we're not getting any back and forth banter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have that. And when people are out here and they're just being looked down upon, you know, because of where they're at doesn't mean that it has to be where they stay at. And when a disaster comes, you know, which you guys, you know, are always in there, you know, I appreciate all of you. You know how big these teams are. There's so many of you out there. And I appreciate all of you because you go and put yourself, you know, in danger because other people are in danger. And it's not because you're trying to get a paycheck out of it. So that's what I love about
you guys.
There's no paycheck. There's no paycheck. There's no paycheck. And that's the part people don't understand. I don't get paid from my charity to do what I do. But there's no payment bigger than getting that thank you.
That's right.
So if I can change someone's life, I'm on it. And
That's how Storm got involved with you and got contact with you. Is we're kind of beyond the scope of our normal disaster relief. We had a homeless man, you know the story, a homeless man came and volunteered with us for 3 weeks. And it wasn't long after he was with us, we saw how great of a worker he was. But it was obvious that he had some mental and emotional challenges. And the more we got to know him and we got a hold of he was actually listed as a missing person. His family thought they knew that he was homeless and in the Fort Myers area, and they thought that he had died or succumbed to, you know, something during the hurricane. And they had been looking for him and had not heard from him for about 2 weeks after the hurricane. And one of his sisters came down to Fort Myers from Mississippi and was putting flyers out. And somebody at another organization knew that he was with us and said, "Hey, isn't this the guy that's with you guys?" And we were like, "Yeah, that's him. That's David." So we got a hold of his family, talked to his family, got his history a little bit, and found out that, you know, not only he had some head injuries, he fell 3 stories and fractured his skull in 7 places. He was diagnosed with autism when he was 6 years old. So he's got several challenges, and he's never been diagnosed properly or had paperwork properly, so he's not on any kind of disability, has no insurance, just basically living in the streets. When he came to stay with us, he said that it was the first time he had been anywhere stable for 3 weeks in over 2.5 years, that he had normally had to leave somewhere every night and go somewhere every night. A lot of people ask, well, why doesn't someone like that just go to the shelters that are around there? Well, someone like this who doesn't have a drug or alcohol addiction or chemical dependency, when they go to these shelters are a lot of times one room with 50 people or 20 people in beds. And a lot of these people are drug or are chemical dependent, and they are coming down off of yesterday's buzz or something like that. And people like David are subjected and victimized. And people like David don't like hostility. They don't like, you know, anger. They don't like anything like that. They don't want to be around it. So he will not go to your traditional shelters. He will not go. And all these other programs are developed. They're out there for housing and stuff, are for drug addicts. So someone like David, who's not a drug addict, they throw him in this program because it's all that there is out there. And, again, it's not right for him. So what we're hoping to do is to reach out to behavioral science and behavioral either doctors or therapists or whatever, and get them on, and other agencies and organizations, and get them on board, because they know and they understand the need for this better than anybody. We discovered it, that people like David have no place to go just by doing disaster relief. And that is what has kind of swayed us to hey, we got to fix this problem. There's no reason why someone like David should be on the streets, perfectly work capable, wants to work, wants to be a good citizen, wants to be, you know, respected and feel constructive and like he's making progress in his life, but needs a lift up. And no one's been willing to give him that lift up because why? Well, one, he's homeless, and there's a kind of, you know, stigma that goes with homeless people. And I've noticed that there's a lot more Davids out there than what we realize. So, yes, these programs that we're talking about aren't just setting up housing. It's setting up the housing and then having like a program coordinator on site, because most of these people can live by themselves, but they just need some assistance once in a while. And if we can get a program going with a program coordinator there to make sure that those needs are being met, then, hey, we've got half the problem left already, and these people are going to have a leg up more than they've ever had in a place safe for them to stay, where they can have a stable living, a stable place to go, not someplace different every night on the street, a meal or two or three meals every day that are good for them, not stuff out of the garbage can, which is what David told me he had been eating, you know, for years. He was even taking food that we were giving him on site and saving it. Meat and things that shouldn't have been saved because it wasn't refrigerated, it was out in the heat, but to him it was still good, and he didn't want to throw it away, because that's when you're homeless and you don't have anything, everything is special to you. And the food we were giving him, even though you and I would have never eaten it, he was saving it for himself to eat later. And I had to tell him, David, don't do that, it's not good for you. We got other food coming in. You know, you're going to get sick or what have you. And it just, being around him for that time and seeing that this guy is just like any other guy you might see holding up a sign that says, I'll work for food or something like that. David wouldn't do that, but other people do. And we have a tendency to look down on these people. And what we don't realize, a lot of these people, not David so much, but a lot of these people are veterans. They were over there in Afghanistan or Iraq for 4 years. And in Vietnam, they were only required to do an 18-month tour. That's it, because there was a draft. And so they could only make people go over there for 18 months. After 18 months, you got done with your tour, and you come back to, you know, your home. You didn't have to serve anymore. But now it's a volunteer military. And what they got going on is that They, because it's volunteer and you signed your name on the dotted line, they can send you over there for your entire tour, 4 years. Well, what happens when you're in a combat zone for 4 years? Your head gets all messed up. There's no way it can't. The things that you're seeing, the combat, most combat is very boring. You're sitting there, nothing ever happens. And then periodically, you get these days where all of a sudden gunfire starts blasting and rockets are being fired at you or whatever, or you run over an IED or something. And all that boredom that you've had for the last 6 months or a year is just shattered in one day. And that's what causes the PTSD and things like that for these guys. And they've been over there for 4 years, so they have these encounters more than once. They get messed, they see some terrible things. They come home to nothing. They come home to no insurance, no housing. A lot of times their wives, if they're married, have left them. It's terrible. And we don't appreciate our veterans enough. And a lot of these veterans are homeless. They're the guys that are holding those signs, I'll work for food. A lot of them do have drug and chemical dependencies. A lot of them are living in the trailer parks we're talking about because they can't seem to make ends meet. They can't seem to hold down a job because of the PTSD and things that are getting in the way. So there's a lot that's being looked over. And I just feel in my heart and in my soul, there's got to be a solution. And the only way we're going to find that solution is people like yourself, Hope for Housing, people like Storm Search and Rescue, and IDRT and some of the other outfits that are out there that we've been talking to get together, because there's power in numbers, and get out there, get the word out, talk to our veteran agencies, talk to our VA, that's what one thing Storm started doing just before Hurricane Ian. We were doing presentations at like Disabled American, DAV, Disabled American Vets, and other VFW halls and stuff. But I think we need to take it a step higher even and go right to the main VA office and tell them, hey, look, this is what we're trying to do. This is what we're all about. Can you give us some support? Can you steer us in a direction? Can you, hook us up with a congressman or a senator and whatever else it's going to take and get these wheels rolling? Because there's definitely a need, and these guys can't wait another day. And it's unfortunate because this has been happening ever since Hurricane Katrina. And every time a hurricane or something comes through, these guys are displaced. They tear down a trailer park and they never rebuild it. Most of the time, they never rebuild it. Or if they do rebuild it, they rebuild some sort of a park that these guys can't afford to stay in. And so there's got to be another solution. And that's what I'm hoping that we're going to be able to do. And the fact that this stuff is, this housing is, environmentally friendly. It's recycled goods. It's it passes all building codes throughout America. The solar powered. It's a win-win for everybody. It's a win for the environment. It's a win for the community. It's a win for the people that live in it. It's a win for the organizations that service these people. It's a win for everything. So I'm excited about that. I'm just hoping we can get this off the ground sooner than later.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you for being here, Rob. I actually just texted the director of Illinois Veteran Affairs. He's the head director. I just texted his cell phone this podcast.
Okay.
I'd like to see him come on here. He's an amazing man. I met him last April, not this April, but a year and a half ago. And, he paid attention. Because we were breaking ground on 3 veterans' homes in Lincoln, Illinois in April last year. And he asked me, I had him on video, it's kind of funny, that he asked me if I had a card, and I told him no. I said, do you have one? And he said, yeah, 2 blocks up the street in my car. I said, does that mean you're going to go get it? This man's like 6'8", so he's like you, L.A. Here I am looking up at him. It was kind of funny because my camera was looking at his chest because he was so tall. But he turned around, and right there on video, you can see him walk away from me. But when he come back, I still have my video going, and you see him walk right up, and I put that card right in front of there. But the one thing is he will support anything we bring to the table. He's all for, you know, making something positive happen. So I did share the link with him and was hoping maybe he might be able to pop in here on that.
Yeah.
His name is Terry Prince, by the way. Definitely cares about the veterans, and he's open for suggestions. And, you know, me and you, you know, you're up in Michigan. So, you know, we know it gets cold. We know what we're dealing with right now. And the thing is we got to think about what are people dealing with that don't have a choice. Because we all have choices. You know, we get to make our own choices in life. But sometimes you just don't have a choice, or other people make your choices for you. And that's where, you know, what are we choosing? What are we doing? So I'll let L.A. talk for a minute. Come on, bro.
If anybody who's on already in the studio, press 1, and then you can join the conversation. So there's some area codes I don't recognize. But so just press 1, and then we can patch into the conversation. I would like to ask, because you're right, a lot of mobile home, communities or parks, they've been bought. The new landlords, which might be some hedge fund, they're raising rents, zoning's changing. What's the price point on a monthly basis that a lot of these people can afford? If anybody knows,
I'm going to make a guess, and it's funny you brought this up, because I was just reading the other day, or maybe I saw something on the news, but we have a congressman or a senator, somebody, a politician, up here in Michigan that's making that one of their campaign pledges, that they're going to go after these landlords. A lot of them are they're non-U.S. citizens. They're foreigners. They're coming over here and they're buying our land. They're buying these trailer parks. And then that's what the problem is in Michigan anyways. I can't speak for everywhere else, but in Michigan, this is what this guy's talking about. And they're buying up all the land. And it's okay. I mean, you know, we're the land of opportunity. If you're a foreigner and you come over and you can buy some land, that's great. But what they're doing is they're coming over here and they're buying the land, and then they're raising the prices on everything, even though they haven't upgraded the properties. And they're calling it, you know, inflation or cost of living raises or whatever else it is. But it's a lot, lot more than that. I would say the average person up here living in a trailer park, they have about $300 a month lot rent. And then their trailers are anywhere from, you know, $500 to $600 a month. So there's, what, $900 right there approximately. And then you have your heating and cooling, and your cable, and your phone, and your groceries, your living expenses. So at the max, I would say like $2,000 a month is where these people are at. And a lot of them are on assistance already, some sort of welfare, food stamps, or something else. So when something like this, like a Hurricane Ian comes through and wipes out the trailer park, and then decides, hey, we're going to put even something more, something bigger or something more expensive in, these people are already at their max financially. They're not going to be able to stay there with the prices going up. And up here in Michigan, you know, we don't have any large disasters like you do in Florida and North Carolina, South Carolina, the South area. But we still got large, large, large trailer parks. I mean, you know, some of them look like cities almost. And a lot of them are double wides. You know, we no longer have a whole lot of single wide trailer parks anymore. Everything's double wide. But they've taken these trailer parks now and they've raised everything. And people can't afford to stay in them at all. And so they're losing, even when they haven't had a disaster, they're losing their place to live just out of affordability. So I really don't know what the answer is to that, but the answer to your question is about $2,000, I think, and that's in Michigan. You know, I guarantee it's probably even higher in Florida, or someplace like that, because, you know, some down in Florida, I noticed when I was down there that everything seems like there's a little bit more money than what we pay for up here.
Okay. Yeah, $2,000. See, I'm looking at one of my barometers are the people who buy these mobile homes and trailers. I would say they're part of what I call the real United States of America. Now, what I mean by that, when a person buys a trailer, they legally own that trailer 100%, and the government can't, well, the government doesn't assess it, and the property taxes on based on it, you can move it wherever you want, although it's expensive to move it. Whereas with real estate, which is your de facto senior partner, is the local taxing authority. You don't pay the municipal water bill. You don't pay those municipal property taxes. They put the property up for auction, you lose it. That necessarily doesn't happen with mobile homes, but as you stated, all those expenses can and do attach to it. I'm figuring some people might use the strategy of, you know what, let me just buy my own land if they can afford it, and or partner up with other people where, you know, they can at least save a little bit of money, save more money. Now, Michigan, I'm familiar with two cities in Michigan, Detroit, and from personal experience, Detroit, which is in Wayne County, and Flint, which is in Genesee County.
And I'm in Flint, brother. I'm in Flint, and I used to live in Wayne County.
Whoa.
I lived in Dearborn. So I'm familiar with both those areas very, very well. Yeah.
Now, I haven't been in Flint since like 2002 or 2003. What's the situation? Did they ever get the water situation straight, the municipal water? How did they resolve that, if they did?
But it hasn't been resolved quite yet. Here's the I'm going to give you my some of it's speculation, but most of it's true, just from the facts I know from the news. But they got like a multi-million-dollar settlement, all right, which is a class action suit, and it's supposed to be spread out between all these people who are affected, mainly kids who are affected educationally because of the lead that they were taking and stuff, the brains didn't develop properly. They're having some behavioral issues and all kinds of stuff. So this lawsuit was supposed to fund school districts and families who are affected, okay? However, the lawyers got their greedy hands on it. And it's been in escrow now, or I don't want to call it escrow, but it's been sitting there and waiting. No one's gotten their hands on it yet because the government is supposed to decide how much the lawyers get and how much the people actually get. And they can't agree on that. So the money's just sitting there. And if you ask me, the money wasn't enough. It really wasn't. They didn't get a very good settlement to begin with. On top of that, they have not replaced all the pipes yet. They're still replacing some of these lead pipes. There are certain areas in Flint right now that are still drinking bottled water because they can't use their water. And it's been going on. Well, it's been going on. We discovered it in 2014. But it's been going on longer than that. That was just when it got discovered. So you think it got discovered in 2014. Here we are in 2022, getting ready to go into 2023, and they still haven't got the pipes fixed? I just don't get it. You know, I don't get what the delay is or the problems. they brought
You think it's a lack of funding because I don't know how Flint's local government is structured, because, like, in some places around the country, local government uses unionized labor, which is expensive.
Yes.
Infrastructure is expensive too. So you think it's a lack of money that could be holding things up?
I think it could be a lack of money. If anything else, it's corruption. We've got a police department in the city of Flint that's been missing $2.5 million for like 5-6 years, and no one's even tried to find out where that money went. We've had multiple people on our city board that they do not get along. They fight with each other all the time. They can't agree on anything. We had a former mayor that was given a large amount of money for the water in 2016, and nobody knows where that money went. It was like $500,000, and nobody knows where that money went. So, you know, there's been money that's come in and disappeared. And here's the catch, is that all these nonprofits flooded into Flint in 2014 and wanted to help and promised to help and said, we can do this and we can do that. And people were desperate, so they were jumping on board with all these nonprofits, and a lot of these nonprofits were scams. And they burnt a lot of people in Flint. So a lot of the initial money they had up front got wasted that way. And what's unfortunate is we developed our nonprofit, Storm Search and Rescue, in 2018. And it's been hard for me I'm actually living in Flushing, Michigan now, which is still in Genesee County, but I grew up in Flint. My mom still lives at the house. I grew up in Flint. I'm in Flint a lot. But what's going on there is that I lost my train of thought now all of a sudden. But the money that was pouring in was taken. We started our nonprofit. That's where it was. We started our nonprofit, and we tried to break in to Genesee County. You know, when I say break in, I mean, you know, with other organizations, we tried to work with them and say, hey, you know, we'd like to help you with this and help you with that. And it's been very difficult because everybody's so skittish about nonprofits. And I couldn't figure out why it was that people were so skeptical of us and didn't want to work with us until I started talking to somebody at United Way and at the University of Michigan, where I went to school. They have a program called the Innovation Incubator, and they helped me establish our nonprofit and get things going. And it was them that told me, Rob, it's because in 2014 all these nonprofits poured in here and just ripped everybody off. So now nobody wants to work with any newer nonprofits they've never heard of. So it's been really a struggle for us locally to break through the weeds here and get people to see what we're trying to do. And because we don't have big disasters up here, people don't understand the need for a search and rescue and disaster relief team. But down there in Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Louisiana, and all that, we get great reception. They love us down there because they know the need for it and they see what we're able to do. But up here, yeah, it's been difficult because they've just been burnt so many times.
Let me ask you this, because all I know about Flint, I used to, when I was living up in Washington, D.C., I would drive to Flint from D.C. Mm-hmm. And
18 hours?
I was looking for inexpensive houses. I mean, my house was like $1,000, $2,000. At that time, this was going back to 2002, back in the 90s, actually. That's when I was doing that. So my question is, does Genesee County, do they have rural areas in Genesee County?
Yeah, I live in a rural area, actually. Flushing and Montrose are probably the most rural, and maybe Clio, which are all Genesee County, but they're the northwest portion of Genesee.
Mm-hmm.
And I am literally a quarter mile from Shiawassee County. I'm right at the Genesee County, Shiawassee County border, but I'm in Genesee. So, and we're all rural out here. I mean, I'm on 3 acres. My property is on 3 acres. And most of the property around here is, you know, people are 3 acres or more.
Yeah, see, the reason why I asked that, I think that the solution, at least a big part of the solution, is, you know, build in rural areas. Whereas, you know, it's just easier to do things politically, financially, everything, in my opinion and based on my personal experience, in rural areas.
Well, here's the problem.
Now, when I was back there in the 90s, I wasn't thinking rural then. That's why I never been. I went to Flint with blinders on, did what I had to do, and then drive back. So I never explored, you know, too much of the state other than those two cities, Detroit, which is not definitely not rural, and the parts of Flint. I was just in and out of Flint. I wasn't even thinking rural back in those days. When I'm thinking, a setup in a rural area might be, you know, of course, now you would have to Well, I think quite a few people might be interested in going rural. Some won't because they've been addicted to the comfort and conveniences of the city life. But to keep a roof over their head, I think some, because I started out in the city, but I love rural stuff now.
Well, me too. Like I said, I lived in Wayne County for a while, and Flint's not a big city, but Wayne County, just, you know, I was 5 minutes from Detroit, the city of Detroit, and I thought I'd never leave the city. I loved it. You know, we were close to Royal Oak and a couple other places, and I loved it. And then my wife and I lost our job. We had a union job at Detroit News, and they went on strike, and we lost our jobs there. They went on strike and never hired us back. They went to what they call a joint operation agreement between Detroit News and Detroit Free Press, and they hired a bunch of replacement workers. And so we lost our job, and we moved down to Virginia where her family was from. We moved to Bland, Virginia, which is just like it says, Bland. It's K through 12 in one school. There's a post office. There's no street light. The town is so small that it's a stop sign. There's no street light. And it's a very small town. It's all like Jefferson National Forest. And I fell in love with the rural. And so when we came back to Genesee County, or back to Michigan, rather, I couldn't go back to the city. Where we're at now, we're close enough to the city where we still have all those amenities and luxuries, basically, but we're far enough out in the country where it's quiet, private, there's no light pollution out here or anything like that. But I wanted to address something you brought up about the rural thing. This is what's happened here in Genesee County. Davison and Grand Blanc, well, not so much Grand Blanc, but Davison used to be quite rural. It's on the east side of Flint, closer to Lapeer, east side of Genesee County, okay. Closer to Lapeer. They went ahead and put several newer double-wide trailer parks in the late 80s and early 90s. And what happens is this. Trailer parks pay school millages and property taxes. But the people that live in those trailers do not. And this is what happens. People like, listen, I live here. I don't have any kids. Our kids are all grown. I've got kids, but they're all grown. They're no longer in school. So I'm paying millage for schools, all right, for the Flushing schools here. And there's somebody whose child is going to benefit from that because I don't have my own children. So my taxes are basically not going towards my child. They're going to go to somebody else's child and help with them. In Davison, you've got people that own homes like us that pay property taxes. But then you open these trailer parks, and you've got poor people that come in, or I say underprivileged or, you know, challenged financially. And they come in, and they've got three, four kids, maybe two or three kids, maybe. It doesn't matter. But they're not paying property taxes. So the kids, these parks are huge parks. And they bring, you know, overnight, these schools are inundated with 1,000 new kids than they had the year before. But they don't have the funding for them. Because they didn't raise the millage, and nobody in the trailer park that has kids is paying child support. They're not child support, property taxes or millages. So the problem is that there is a lot of people who frown on bringing trailer parks to rural areas, and that's what's going on out here where I live in Flushing. The reason why Flushing's property value has stayed up where it's at is because the people on our city board and county board, or not county board, but city board here in Flushing Township, refuse to let anybody build here unless it's a single family dwelling and it has to be on 5 acres or more, or you can't build here. And that was the township that made that stipulation because they didn't want parks going in here or apartment complexes or anything like that because they saw what happened to Davison and they didn't want that to happen here. I don't necessarily agree with it, but it is what it is. And that's what you're going to have. If you try to go to a rural area, people that live in the rural areas like the way things are. They don't like change. And they know if you build a park in their area, things are going to change. The school system's going to be affected. Taxes are going to be affected. The community's going to be affected by the influx of people coming to that area. So it's really up to the local community, and I don't want to say every community out there that's a rural community is like this. I hope not, But that is the problem you're going to have. And then I wanted to address one other thing. I thought about this last night, Chris. You know, we have a contact who has 100 acres and may be willing to donate some of that to us. I haven't approached them yet because I'm waiting to get some particulars together. But here's the obstacle we have. If we tell them that we're using this property, which we have to, that we're using this property to develop a program for people with mental and emotional challenges, and that there's going to be, you know, a program there. Well, let's say they wanted to, they're going to give us 5 acres, so they still have 95 more acres, and they want to develop that someday, build a subdivision or something like that back there. All right? They may reject us just because on donating that land just because of what we want to do with it. Because future homeowners don't want to live close to something like that. It's really sad. But that's where our society is at. They don't understand. They're like, oh, we got people back there with mental and emotional challenges. Well, what if they break into my house? Or what if they, you know, what if they go crazy one night and come over here and kill us or something? Well, they're not. You know, they just stereotype everybody and paint everybody with the same brush, and that's not the kind of people we're talking about here, you know. But they don't know that, and they don't care. They hear the word mentally challenged or emotionally challenged, and right away they want to, you know, throw that out there. So we have obstacles when it comes to this because we have a lot of judgmental people who believe everything they hear and half, you know, everything they see. And there's not, you know, it's really hard to break through that and to get them to understand the need. And that's why we have these needs, why these needs are getting so much greater, because we're running into brick walls like that and obstacles like that everywhere we go. And that's what I'm starting to realize. But that's why it's important to get this power in numbers. You know, we can get a collective co-op of organizations that work in these areas together. You know, it's just like having a special interest group, right? I seen this thing that Princeton did not too long ago. You're going to like this. Princeton did a study. It was Princeton or Penn State, one of them. I think it was Princeton. Did a study. And they said, you can take a bill in Congress that has, that 60% of the population hates. And 60% of the population does not want it to go through. And it won't go through. You can have a bill that 60% of the population likes, okay? And a lot of times it won't go through. But if you have a program that 60% of the population hates, but you have a special interest group that goes in there and says, hey, we want this, guess what? It goes through. Regardless of what the population thinks, because you know, the special interest group's got money, and they're putting money in somebody's campaign. So they know this. I mean, that's common sense. They didn't have to do a study to know this, but now they know that it's true, that our Congress, you know, they're swayed by special interest, and they're not really swayed by the popular vote or popular opinion. So we have to organize our own special interest group. We have to get people who, veteran groups, you know, groups that deal with challenged people, and groups like our own that do this, and approach these people, these congressmen, these senators, our politicians, our leaders out there, and let them know, hey, look, this is good for everybody. Because if we keep doing what we're doing now, basically what they're doing now is they're putting blinders on. They're like ostriches. They're burying their head in the ground hoping that it goes away. And it just keeps worse and worse and worse. It's like that person who does drugs just to forget their problems. They wake up the next morning, the problem's still there, and now it's worse than it was the day before. Well, it's the same thing that our politicians are doing. They're going to sleep, going out, you know, medicating themselves, basically. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But going out, medicating themselves with all this fake information or whatever, and the money from the special interest groups, and ignoring the real problem. And when they wake up the next day, the problem's still there. It's only worse now. And no one's addressing it. And that's where we're at.
I think one strategy
would be, and this is still the rural thing. You're right. A lot of these rural areas do, and there's a bunch of them out there. They really don't want overdevelopment, and I don't blame them. But and if you bring too many people out or build too many houses in a particular area, then they'll call it a subdivision, and that brings in a whole other kettle of fish. So what I personally do is I look at, like, if let's say it's a 20-acre lot, and I'm thinking about one I know about right here in Florida. It's a 20-acre lot, and I'm allowed to put – anybody who bought the land, they would be allowed to put one house per acre. One house per acre on each lot. However, there's no limit to the amount of buildings. And buildings and houses, although a house is a building, but legally speaking, listen, in this particular county, you know, a barn is a building. It's not a house. A shed, anything below 250 square feet, it's a building, but it's not a house. So, in areas like that, you know, you could, where I'm going is, instead of having, a large community, just really break it down to small communities. Like in Germany, and I picked up this concept over in Germany. In Germany, a small village is called a Dorf, D-O-R-F. So I ran across quite a few Dorfs in Germany, and just some had about maybe three or four households. That's it. So I think that might be a strategy you might want people to look at. Also, another thing would be price point. Now, you're absolutely right on that $2,000 per month price point, but some of the people that I've run into, this happened to be about a year ago. I was because I'm in Florida right now. I'm on a little bit over a quarter acre land here. So I was looking at, I didn't want to rent out a room or nothing because they had headaches from that. So I said, well, I got a nice sized backyard with citrus trees and space for somebody to pitch a tent. So I put an ad up for a tent for rent. I mean, for people that want to camp or whatever. And because you got a bunch of people on Airbnb that like to do that. So I advertised for that, but who called me, and it was a bunch of them, were people that they wanted a place to park. They wanted, can I move my camper back there? And long story short, I ended up renting out my car for like $400 a month. Now, in that, I discovered, and I call these people the Walmart crowd. I ran across a bunch of people that their monthly household budget, and they have jobs, is around $400 to $500 a month. So I've always kept that in mind because, like, $2,000 a month, man, $2,000, this is why I discovered Flint. When I was driving from Flint to Washington, D.C., and that's a long drive solo, I was coming up to Flint because I was looking to buy $500 to $1,000, no more than $2,000 houses. That's why I was Flint back. That's why I was coming to Flint in the '90s. I wasn't thinking about rural, but now I know. Hell, give me the same $2,000 or whatever, I'm going to Home Depot, Lowe's, and Menards, and I'm building something. That's where I'm at now.
Now, where did you come up with that $400? For these guys, what you call the Walmart crowd, is that because they're staying in a camper that they own outright? They don't have to pay rent.
What I discovered that some of these people are doing is they'll go on like Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist, and they'll look for a camper or a mobile home that needs some work, and they'll buy it at this one lady that I ran across. She was sending me stuff from Facebook Marketplace 2 or 3 times a week. These campers, I mean, like, for instance, she came across a camper for $1,000, all right, and then she negotiated that down to $500, and that's what she lives in today.
Yeah,
and I discovered there's quite a few people like that. Now, you're going to do some hunting on that, but not much hunting. But there's an audio I play on here where the guy built a cabin for he built it for $2,000. He built it himself. It took him about a week or two to build it, let's say 2 weeks. And then he spent another three because he powers his place with solar. Now, the American public really isn't there yet with all that. But I'm just saying the rural areas, if you get into the right rural county, and like me personally, I buy land that's zoned agricultural. I don't buy anything that's zoned residential. That's just my niche. But because Michigan, I mean, once you get outside of Flint, Detroit, I'm naming cities now, not counties. Detroit, Flint, I haven't been to Bay City or Saginaw. Grand Rapids on the western side of the state. And it might be like Traverse City, which is further up north. But Michigan basically is mostly a rural state. Am I correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I have an aunt that lives in, she grew up here, but she left here when she was like 18. She's in her 90s now. And she came back just recently because her husband died. My uncle died. So she came back here to be around her remaining brothers and sisters that are here. Believe it or not, they're still around too. And she could not believe how, because it had been a long time since she's been here, she could not believe how much unsettled land we have here in forestry. That, because, you know, in California, everything's on top of each other, just like it is in Florida pretty much. And
right.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought that up. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm listening.
No, I mean, we're pretty much all rural. I was surprised when I was down in Florida. We went down there for Hurricane Michael in Gadsden County for Midway, the town of Midway, and we did our disaster relief there for them for the panhandle when they got hit by Hurricane Michael. And I was surprised that there was all that forestry there. I didn't even know that Florida had.
Let me lay out Florida for you. Florida has we have 67 counties down here. All right. Once you step outside of Dade County, where Miami is, Broward County, where Fort Lauderdale is, because they're connected to each other, Pinellas, and Hillsborough County, where Tampa is, and St. Pete. I'm in Polk County, Florida. Orlando is in Orange County, and then Tallahassee, that county, and Duval County, where Jacksonville is, at 7 counties. Step outside of those, and then maybe up in Gainesville, where the University of Florida is. Step
and
outside
Cali,
of those places. Yeah. Florida is basically a rural state. Huh? Yeah. Florida is basically a rural state.
Okay. All right.
Matter of fact, most states are rural states. And that's why I suggest people look at rural areas, and you might have to pick up a new – like, look, I'm learning carpentry. But I'm looking at – To sustain yourself in a large city, man, it's expensive. You have to become wealthy. If you want to live in Chicago and you're not pulling in a certain amount of money a month, forget living in Chicago.
Right. Yeah, when I lived in Wayne County, it was way expensive. We worked for the Detroit News, me and my wife. We both had really good jobs. My ex-wife, we had really good jobs. But this is back in the early 90s, and it cost me then, my house payment was, we rented, but the house payment was like $1,200 a month, plus expenses and everything, and that was a lot. That house now in Wayne County is probably $3,000 a month, and that's just for the rent.
Now, hold it, that had to be outside, is that outside of Detroit, someplace like Bloomfield or Bloomfield Hills, Michigan?
Dearborn. It was in Dearborn.
Say no more.
It was in Dearborn. It was in Dearborn. It was
Dearborn.
It was in a historic, Yeah, it was the historical part of Dearborn, too. It was by the TPP golf course and, you know, Henry Ford Museum and stuff. It was kind of expensive in that area. They're older homes, but they're all well-maintained, and they're nice, safe, suburban-type communities, you know. And, yeah, they're expensive there because the people live there and they commute to Florida. Or not to Florida, I'm sorry. They commute to Detroit to work. You know, they go downtown and work in Detroit, then they come back and stay in Dearborn, you know.
You have quite a few merchants that live in Dearborn, but like you say, they own businesses in Detroit.
Yes. They own or work for businesses in Detroit. And what we're trying to see now is it's expanding. Genesee County's taxes are a lot cheaper than Oakland County's taxes, and Oakland County borders Wayne County. So people were moving to Oakland County and traveling into Detroit to work, and that's about a 30-minute drive. But now they're coming to Genesee County because our taxes are cheaper and our houses are cheaper, and we're more rural. So they're coming to Genesee County and buying and commuting to Detroit. So the commute's getting bigger. People are willing to make a bigger commute to work to save money on their housing. I don't know how that's working out with gas prices the way they are right now, but that's what we're starting to see here. People are spread. The people are willing to drive further to work to put themselves in a place that's got cheaper housing and more affordable living conditions.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this now: for veterans up that way in Michigan, would at least a critical mass of them be willing to move to a rural area in Michigan?
Say that again? I guess I didn't quite hear you.
Would veterans up there be willing to move to a rural community in Michigan?
I think most of them would. I think most of them would.
Okay.
And most of them already do, kind of. Like these trailer parks that they're living in up here in Michigan are, you know, like north of me is Clio and Birch Run. And there's a couple of trailer parks up there in Birch Run and newer ones that just got built recently, you know, in the last 10 years. And I would say a lot of our veterans are living in those areas. They'd be willing to live in a rural area for sure.
There's something that Chris said last week or the week before that. That whatever services that people, whether they're vets or not, whatever services that might exist in the city, because people both basically live in the city for comfort and convenience, is if you bring it out to those rural areas, you know, there's less people, less crime, you know, less headaches, so to speak.
Yeah.
So.
What they've got here, like in Birch Run, for instance, in Clio, they've got a small city area. That has, and I say small, I mean small compared to any other city. You know, it's a small city area that has a Walmart, a Menards, a Home Depot, a Lowe's, a Tractor Supply, some gas stations, and restaurants, and pretty much in a couple of grocery stores maybe, and everything people need, all right? And they can drive. It's like anywhere from a 5 to a 15-minute drive for most people from the rural setting that they're living in to drive there to get the things that they need. It's like we are here in Flushing. I can drive 15 minutes southeast of me here, and I can find a Meijer's, a Walmart, a Kroger grocery store, all the restaurants that, you know, and pizzerias and anything else I might want. They're all right there. And it's kind of like congested little strip on Pearson Road. And that's where everybody in Flushing goes for most of their things. But then we drive back to our homes and you know, 15 minutes away, and we're in the country. And that's how a lot of these rural towns in Michigan are. They've got a small city's infrastructure with all their needs accessible to them. And it's a short drive from their home, but basically the living community around those towns is all rural. And so people are willing to move to these rural areas because they do have their needs. Everything they need is not too far away.
You're absolutely right about that.
It used to be you had to go to bigger cities, you know, to find that stuff. But now, you know, because of places like Walmart and Home Depot and stuff, they're building, you know, right off the expressway,
And, you know, so it's easy to get on and get off with these trucks to do the deliveries and, you know, everything else. But yet, if you go a little bit further down the road off the expressway, you get into these rural communities. And what they do is they just drive up towards the expressway where everything's at, get everything they need, and go back to their homes. And so, right. You know, that's how everything is structured here. And people up here say, well, Michigan's a blue state or it's a red state or whatever. We're not. We're a purple state. And I say that, and I'm only bringing that up. I don't even like to inject politics into anything. But I only bring that up because the blue part of our state is Genesee and Wayne County.
Right.
For the most part, in Oakland County. All right. The rest of the state is red. Almost always in our elections. But there's more people in the inner city in Oakland, Genesee, and Wayne County than there is pretty much in all those other rural areas of the state of Michigan. So whenever
right,
we have
that's
election,
another reason why, yeah, that's another reason why yeah. I like, because when I was looking at a 5-unit building in Detroit, and as soon as the guy told me they found a decapitated body in the backyard, I was done.
Yeah.
I was, man, yeah. Detroit's off the chain.
Yeah, but, the crime rate is pretty
not
bad.
To say that the rural areas don't have crime, but it's just, I economically speaking, I think it's just more sustainable to set up house in a rural area.
And it's safer. You bring that up,
yeah, it's
but
safe,
it is.
It's safer. Yeah.
Yes, I'll give you an example. I drove to Flint a couple of years ago. A buddy of mine died. And his wife called me and said, Rob, Joe's passed. And, you know, we called the ambulance, the coroner or whatever. They're going to come get him. But he had been dying of cancer, and you know, he died at home peacefully. And so I was driving over there to see him, and I was running out of gas. I left in a quick hurry and didn't even pay attention. I got a diesel. And as I was driving over there, my diesel started sputtering, and I only be able to run out of gas with a diesel, out of fuel the diesel, but it's hard to get them started back up because you have to burp the fuel lines and all this other stuff. So I didn't want to run out of gas, so I stopped at this gas station I wouldn't normally stop at. It was in a kind of a bad area. And I stopped there and was filling up my truck, and I got ready to leave, and this guy was parked in front of me filling his car up, and he had a passenger on the passenger side who opened up the door and hit my truck with it. And so I rolled down my window and was getting ready to say, hey, you know, what's going on, you know? And the guy pulled a gun on me. And he said, go ahead, say something. Say something. He put the gun right to my head. And I just punched my gas and took off. I didn't even stick around. I was afraid he was still going to shoot me or something, you know? And I punched my gas and took off. And that would have never happened 10 years ago in that same spot. I grew up over there, and that would have never, ever happened. But the thing is that the city areas, Flint, Detroit, they're purposely letting these bad neighborhoods go bad. They're purposely not upgrading these homes or doing anything. I was part of the University of Michigan's Flint back in the early 90s. I worked for the Governmental Relations Department for the president of University of Michigan Flint and his Governmental Relations Department. And I sat in on some meetings where they were talking about the future of Flint and how the university was going to play a part in that. And basically they were talking then, back in the 90s, about letting these neighborhoods fall apart and then not rebuilding them, but going back through after they fall apart and after they get rid of all the gangs and the prostitution and the drugs and get them out of that area, then they start tearing down the houses one by one by one, and then the university is going to go back in there and build university property. So it's helping the university, and it's helping the city of Flint in terms of getting rid of the blight and the eyesores. But what's happening to all those people that live there? They're being displaced. They have no place to live. That was where all the cheaper rental housing was at. And now they're getting rid of all that cheap rental housing. And they're doing that in Detroit, too. There's parts of Detroit that are purposely letting it fall apart.
That's happening in Baltimore. because John Hopkins up there, they've been buying up quite a bit of stuff for a number of years up that way.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is something that's being done intentionally. It's not this is their way of dealing with blight and dealing with crime. They think, well, we'll just get it out. We'll just get it out of our town. Which it does. It gets it out of your town, but they just move somewhere else. They move to another town. You know? And so you're not really getting rid of it. You're just putting a Band-Aid on it and sending making the problem
somebody else's.
One thing
that you brought up earlier in this conversation is a lot of people, we really shouldn't be living on top of each other as we're doing in a lot of these highly urbanized cities.
Oh, no. You're absolutely right. COVID taught us that. In fact, that's what happened. That's a lot of reasons why rent is so high right now. Because when COVID came around, everybody that lived in the cities on top of each other, especially families with children, were like, I don't want to be here. If this thing is that contagious, I don't want to be around all these people. So the first thing they did is they flew out of the cities, like New York and Chicago and everywhere else, the people that could afford to, and they bought up housing in these rural areas or these areas where they could at least have single-family housing and didn't have to be, you know, in a building with a bunch of other people. And a lot of them started renting these houses, too. So the cost of rent went up because rental housing became hard to find. People were buying up all the rental houses or people were willing to pay more for rental housing to get out of the city. So the prices started going up and the demand started going up, but the need of the access to these rental homes went down. People, not the need, but the access to these rental homes went down. There's fewer of them available. So, you know, product and demand. There's less product, more demand. So the prices are going up. And unfortunately, we've got some people who see that as an opportunity to make money, and they're buying up the trailer parks and the apartments, and they're raising the rent on those and in these rural areas because they know people are trying to flood out of the cities. So it's and our government's not doing anything about it, just like they don't do anything about gas gouging. They talk about it all the time, but I can drive down the road right now, go to one gas station where diesel might be $5.39 a gallon, and go a half mile down the road and find it for $5.10 a gallon. And there's no reason for it. But it's happening all over. I saw it when I was coming back from Florida for Hurricane Ian. Some states I was going through was like $4.50 a gallon. I couldn't believe it was that cheap. And other states I was going to, it was $5.50 a gallon. I couldn't figure out why there was a dollar difference from one state to the next.
Right.
And our government knows this, but they don't do anything about it. And until they do, until they stop these business owners from gouging people and taking advantage of us, it's going to be up to us to do something about it because our government's not going to do it.
That's true.
That's right.
Is there any Amish or Mennonite presence in Michigan?
Say that again.
Any Amish or Mennonite communities in Michigan?
There is, but they're very, very small. Most people go down to Illinois or Indiana. What is it? Shipshawana?
I know quite a few in Indiana.
There's Shipshawana there. That's where most people from Michigan go when they want to see an Amish or buy Amish goods. They go down to Shipshawana. That's like the closest, largest Amish community near us. Now, when I lived in Virginia, we had a big Amish community down there called the Whitegate community. And they're quite a large Amish community. But no, we don't have many up here in Michigan. Not many.
Okay. Michigan seems like the land of opportunity.
Well,
here's
the other thing about that. Like you mentioned Traverse City earlier, all right? I've been reading articles, and they're saying that Michigan, by the year 2070, is going to be the new prime place to live for people. They're not going to want to live in California or Florida anymore. As a result of climate change, the temperatures up here are getting warmer. Our winters are getting milder. Our summers are getting longer. And we don't have hurricanes We don't have forest fires. We don't have hardly anything. We got an occasional tornado, and they're not even that bad anymore. Like I said, our winters aren't that bad anymore.
What about the UP? Which next time I come up that way, I want to visit the UP. But what's the activity up that way?
Nothing. The UP is like Alaska. Most of the people in the UP live there full time, or they're just hunting cabins and the snowmobile cabins and things like that. During the hunting seasons, you know, from October through December, you'll have people up there in those cabins. But the rest of the year, or in the summertime, you'll have them up there. But the rest of the year, there's nobody up there, except for the people that live there full time. It's a lot like Alaska. They get like 9 feet of snow in November.
Mm. Now, for people that don't know, UP stands for Upper Peninsula. Michigan's
That's
a peninsula state. It's got two, lower and upper.
That's right. And we call them Upers. The Upper Peninsula people are called Upers.
Upers, okay.
Yeah. And
next time I'm in that state, I want to explore that region. But like I said, I just got limited to – I just did Detroit and Flint. But like I said, when I was there for that, I wasn't even thinking about rural. But now I'm rural, and Michigan's got a lot of land up that way.
Yeah. Yeah, so what they were saying is that 2007, this is going to be the prime spot to be. And what's happened is during COVID – a lot of celebrities discovered Traverse City. We had Paris Hilton, Justin Bieber, and a bunch of other, you know, celebrities. Some of them already own land up there. We have Bob Seger, Kid Rock, and some of those other people who are from Michigan already own land up there. But there's a lot of celebrities that have never been to Michigan before, never lived here before, that are buying up land up there now because – it's all vineyards. It's all wine vineyards. It's on Lake Michigan. It's beautiful. We was up there for a wedding
and,
this summer.
And it's, I know there's the Windsor Bridge goes from Detroit. I mean, the Detroit into Canada, Windsor Bridge. I think it's called the Windsor Bridge. Oh, it goes into Windsor, Canada. Now, there's a bridge up in the upper part of Michigan that goes over Canada too, isn't it?
No, there's two bridges that go to Canada. There's the Ambassador Bridge in Detroit. That's the one that goes to Windsor. And then in Port Huron, there's the Blue Water Bridge, and that goes to Sarnia, Canada. That goes from Port Huron to Sarnia. Those are the only two bridges we have. We have the Mackinac Bridge, but that connects the Lower Peninsula to the Upper Peninsula.
Oh, got it. Okay.
There's no way of getting into Canada through the UP. Because you have Lake Superior separating you from – you'd have to cross Lake Superior to get to Canada. Yeah.
All right. No, I've been across the Ambassador and the Windsor, and I just – you know, as a matter of fact, a friend of mine, I lost track of her, but she went over – I guess she crossed the Ambassador Bridge. She went – I don't know, she discovered some over in Canada and didn't come back for 5 years. So I guess
she must have liked it.
Where was she ended up? Nice.
Yeah.
But, Michigan has a lot to offer.
It really does. It really, really does. If you can handle the cold. You know, if you can handle the cold, that's the thing, you know. I myself got three cages in my back. I got a fusion in my back. I'm just saying, these winters are getting harder and harder. You know, I mean, the snows aren't that bad, but it's just the cold weather. You know, if you can handle the cold weather, Michigan's not bad. It's not bad at all. You know?
I know when I was in Detroit.
Thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I was just saying,
when I was in Michigan for, it was a 3 week period of time where the highest the temperature got was 19 degrees. And you know, that's obviously below zero. So when I went outside, I had on like two pair of thermal underwear, three pairs of socks and gloves. And within a minute, well, let's say 2 or 3 minutes, I would feel like my needles were being stuck in my fingertips. And then when the weather finally warmed up to,
It got up to be about 30, which is still below freezing, but it felt mm-hmm. like almost spring. So you're right. If mm-hmm. you're going to live up in Michigan, and that's Detroit, that's not the top of the state by no stretch of the imagination. No. You need to dress warm.
Yeah, it was funny. When I was down in Florida, people down there were wearing hoodies when it got down to like 65 degrees at night. And I'm still walking around in my T-shirt and shorts. I'm going, why are you guys wearing hoodies and stuff? Like, oh, it's cold. I'm going, 65 degrees ain't cold. It's great, you know. But
no, you're
right. There's the difference. Yeah, there's the difference there. But, yeah, these people, the thing is, again, these are wealthy people that are moving here, buying up property. They only stay here during the summer months when it's nice, and they go back to, we call them snowbirds. They go to Florida or California or wherever else they have places and go there during the winter. Most people
well,
can't
now,
afford
Traverse, to do that. Isn't Traverse, I haven't been to Traverse City, but isn't Traverse like a resort town up there?
It is now, it's a wine country. They've got a bunch of vineyards up there now, and really good vineyards. I mean, they're making some high quality wine. It's kind of like Silicon Valley for in California, but for vineyards, you know. And it's a resort town. It's a lot of marinas, some casinos. A lot of nice restaurants and things like that. And, of course, everything's right on Lake Michigan, which is our most beautiful Great Lake. The waters of Lake Michigan are much like the waters down near the Keys. You got, like, in Florida, parts of Florida, where you got seven different shades of aqua blue, you know, and just it's just gorgeous. And it's completely transparent and clear and just beautiful, beautiful water. And, again, no sharks, no nothing like that in these waters. So you got these big, big bodies of water that are just like the ocean in Florida or California, anywhere else, but you don't have the risk of getting yourself eaten by an animal or something every time you get in the water. So there's all these things that people are starting to realize about Michigan, and as a result, they're moving here. And all the projections say that Michigan's going to be developed a lot more in the coming years because of it. So now's the time to get into Michigan, I guess, if you want to do something. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, let me turn this back over to Chris. Chris, any comments before we wrap up today?
Well, I was checking to see if Carlos might be in the queue.
I haven't seen him. He didn't pop in today. His area code hasn't popped in. I tried to call him, but the call kept on dropping. So I don't know. I know they had like seven tornadoes that ripped through. And one of the states was South Carolina or Georgia. So I don't know if a tower's been knocked down or anything, but I haven't seen him on the switchboard today.
I saw last night the tornado ripped through Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. And I think it was one in the northern part of Florida, too.
Okay,
I don't know if they all did damage.
Last time I spoke to Carlos, he was in South Carolina, so maybe a tower.
Yeah,
Carlos is from Virginia, and he's down there in Miami now. The art show starts at 12 o'clock and goes till 6 p.m. every day. But he did text me. He asked me if the show was still going. I said, yes, come on. So I didn't know if maybe he had called in. He's probably busy in the middle of the art show now.
No, their area code hasn't popped up today. So.
Okay.
But we're here tomorrow, Monday through Friday. So, you know, if he's available, he can call in tomorrow.
Yeah, we'll get him on here tomorrow. I'd like to get Rob back on here because he wants to meet you, Rob. He's the one that I was speaking about. He's the old veteran there that has the greenhouses. You know, we didn't even talk about that today.
I listened to that episode. I listened to the podcast
where
he was
greenhouses
on.
Where we can grow fish, vegetables, and mushrooms in the same room. Now, the thing about what he did was he went to all of the people that are specialists
in growing, and they said that it could not be done. And the thing is nothing's impossible. It's impossible. Because if we can actually show in factual motion, then the only reason it's not happening is because we're not doing it. Because he didn't want to hear that he couldn't do it. He wound up seeing that he had a dark spot in his greenhouse, and he wanted to do it. They said he can't be done. He's been doing it for 12 years. But when he tells me every week in a 3-foot by 3-foot bed, it grows 10 pounds of mushrooms, now we're talking about a resource for people to make money. And the fish, you know, catfish are so much a pound, you know, if you're not going to eat them, you can sell them. But koi fish, you can buy a small koi fish for $20. You grow it into an adult, which it will grow in this water, $1,000. To me, I'd like to have all these things going and not have the necessarily tank in there that's you're eating the fish. You got a tank in there that every day is growing interest. It's getting bigger. It's a retirement plan. That's what we have here. We have an ability to do something amazing. And Rob, he lost the call. He just texted me. He said, sorry. Definitely, you know, we do have an opportunity here. Everyone an opportunity. And I think that's what we need to embrace the most is, are we doing something today for someone else besides ourselves? Because if you already got what you want, I guarantee there's somebody in need that needs something they want.
Right.
And, you know, that's what we got. That's what I want to change. I want to change people's perception to that, you know. And I'm not a preacher. The thing is I don't speak religion. No one's heard me do that. What you hear me speak is humanity. Because humanity has been here before religion was written. So it's who you are is going to define what your life is going to be. But you don't even know. A lot of people have no clue how much stuff you're able to do. What is out there? Because people go through life with blinders on. They need to take the blinders off. We need to turn their dimmer switch on and click their light to going bright. Because once everybody's light's lit up, it's going to be brilliant. But people's got to come out of the dark to do that.
Right.
And
all right. Well, let's see. What's tomorrow? Friday?
Yes, sir.
All day.
Okay. So, all right. Let's see. Carlos has down in Miami. He's got the greenhouse, right?
He didn't bring the greenhouse. He has all of the diagrams of the skyscrapers and everything. So, and we do have a metaverse that if anybody reaches out, I will send it to you. And there is an art gallery that is in the sky that everybody can walk through at the same time. You can see all these people going through it. You can actually wind up having conversations with people. You can be on the phone talking to somebody and walking through the gallery, both of you. You can be talking on the phone and both of you going through the gallery. And
what about,
you know,
now,
this is
anybody, is anybody going to be there with tiny houses?
As far as I know, they were supposed to bring the tiny house. Of course, I'm not there, and I haven't spoke to them today. I'm not sure if the tiny house made it over there or not. There was a problem with maybe not having room for it because it was 27 feet long. So it might
because
not be
that,
there.
That event, well, that's being held indoors, isn't it?
It's indoor and outdoor.
Okay. All right, because I was thinking the guy brought up from Flint. What's his name from Flint?
Rob.
Oh, Rob. Okay, Rob from Flint. When he was on here, I think a price point where it's
I think once you go above $500 a month, you're knocking out a lot of people. Then people are starting to get into the struggle mode. I think $400 to $500 a month with the $500 at the peak. Because anything $2,000 a month is luxury in my opinion.
Yeah, you'd be living well at $2,000. I mean, you should be able
right,
to.
Right, because
anyway.
I'm looking at, like I say, the market that I go after is the Walmart crowd, and like I say, one of my barometers, like I said, one lady that was looking at something I had for rent, she lives in the $500 a month. I mean, no, she paid for a camper $500. So she's mortgage free. So she was looking out, she was renting out somebody's backyard. So I think that's where the United States is. Anything above $500 for monthly household expenses. Now, granted, you do have when you're paying $1,000 or more a month, you're getting. And I'm gonna work on those statistics today for tomorrow. You're talking about the 1%. So you have a lot of people that are paying $1,000 or $2,000 a month rent, but they're struggling to do that. I had a friend of mine, he passed away about 6 years ago, this past September. And I was talking to his widow, and she told me they were paying for a two-bedroom apartment in Aspen Hill, Maryland. That's outside of Washington, D.C. He took care of the rent part in their marriage. He was paying $1,700 a month rent for an apartment, two bedroom. And I didn't know, man, I could give me two used Rolls Royces for that, $900 a month on a lease. So had I known that, I would have told him, man, well, you need to go to Hagerstown in West Virginia where you can, you know, cut all that in half or even a fraction of that and live a sustainable lifestyle. So, Chris, that's why I like what you're talking about, the manufacturing part of this, where we can manufacture sustainable housing, where if they do have a mortgage, it's something that you can pay off like a car note at worst comes worst. Or we teach them how to build the house, then they don't have a mortgage. So those are my thoughts on that. All right, so
yeah,
tomorrow you'll be – what's that?
You can actually have a good-paying job.
Yeah. Yep,
now, we're not asking people to do something for free. But people in the community can come out and give an hour or two. You know, if you gave up an hour or two of your time and you were able to save someone from suffering for the rest of the year, for the next year, was it worth your 2 hours? Or would you rather just go and sit at your house and watch some television show for those 2 hours? Or and then throughout the year get to see that person suffer. You know, it's what we do not for ourselves, but how we benefit from it. Because the one thing you're gonna get is you're gonna get a true thank you. And I know that Rob has got those true thank yous. And that's one reason that we do the things that we do, because it's not about a monetary gain. And that's the problem. You know, we've been talking about it. There's money, 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 money. How much is it going to cost per month? How much is this going to cost? This is the problem. Because if somebody ain't putting money in their pocket and putting it in the bank, they're not going to help you. So,
you know who I think we need to partner with? There's a small group of people I know. I don't know them personally or nothing, but I heard them on Clubhouse. What they do is they'll go lease a house, and then they'll rent out. They rent out the place by the bed. They're getting $600
a month
for beds.
I know all about it. Yep.
So And you know, they might be putting two in a room and all that, and I think that's an accident waiting to happen, but that's another story. That's what they're doing. I'm thinking, you know, and now they're getting a lot of their leads from social workers, hospitals, reentry people out of the prison system. So I think if we partner or find a social worker or two, that will, because that'll give us the community that we need anywhere we want to go. Because we just say, instead of spending that $600 for a bed, we could, like he said, if you're on Section 8, you can be a homeowner. But most people on Section 8 don't know it.
None of them know it. None of them know it.
You're right. None of them know it. So instead of spending that $600 on a bed, all right, get the $600. Let's go. Well, you know, you got you have your factory or factories. They can put in the factory, get some, building parts made, and, you know, we just teach them how to assemble it, and they own it. And absolutely nobody's doing that. So, all right, we'll get on that tomorrow and get an update on the art thing. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.